Today on the 21st.
They're fighting for a cause, sexism, racism, budget cuts, all that. We all are affected by it.
Students protesting at Southern Illinois University in Carbondale yesterday are just the latest in a series of demonstrations that are happening all over Illinois campuses. Today we ask, where do you draw the line with free speech on a college campus? Whose responsibility should it be? Give us a call at 1-800-222-9455 or tweet us at 21st Show. Plus, the animals at Wildlife Prairie Park in Hanna City were getting a bit pudgy, and something had to be done about it.
With Molly, our black bear, we actually started an exercise program with her. So we started jogging with her, and she would jog along the fence lines with her keepers.
We'll learn about the not-so-surprising diet secrets of wildlife animals. That's all this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. You're listening to the 21st. Welcome. I'm Nyla Boodoo, and those were students at Southern Illinois University in Carbondale yesterday, protesting against student debt and racism. Some students said they came out in protest of an anonymous video that called for violence against African-American students on that campus. It's just the latest in what's been a busy year for issues around free speech on college campuses, whether that's the Trump protests at UIC, to Black Lives Matter movements, to anti-immigrant chalk writing on sidewalks, and debates over safe spaces and trigger warnings. Yes, campus administrators across the state and the country continue to face complaints of violating the free speech of both students and faculty. But many advocates say the conversation about speech on campus has changed in recent years. Students, they say, are now more likely to push back against speech they see as offensive and to support safe spaces for learning in a culture of respect. As the power dynamic shifts on many campuses when it comes to speech, today on the 21st, we're going to talk about where the limits of free speech are on a college campus and who gets to decide. I know that many of you listening in right now are on college campuses, from Illinois State to Bradley to the University of Illinois. We want to hear from you on this. What do you see as the limits of free speech on your campus, and how has that changed? You can join our conversation by calling us. Our phone number is 1-800-222-9455. That's 1-800-222-9455. Or you can tweet us at 21st Show. That's 21st Show. We're going to hear from the students a bit later. Let's start with the responsibility of campus administrators when it comes to free speech. Alice Dreger was a professor at Northwestern University's Feinberg School of Medicine, Chicago, for about a decade until she resigned in protest last summer, and she joins us now by phone from Michigan. Alice, welcome to the 21st.
Thanks for having me, Nala.
Alice, you were, maybe we should bring people up to speed with your case if people were not familiar of what happened last August. You were asked to guest edit an edition of the publication Atrium. So for people who aren't familiar with that, what's Atrium?
Atrium is a publication, a journal put out by the Medical Humanities and Bioethics program where I was a professor at Northwestern. And the idea behind it was to print short articles and essays by people who were medical professionals or bioethicists or patients about experiences in medicine. And it was always centered around a particular theme. And the issue that I edited was centered around the theme of bad girls.
Right. And so that's the theme, bad girls. Everything seemed fine until after the publication. Then what happened?
Yeah, we went through all the normal systems, you know, checking each other's work, calling for proposals, deciding whose proposals would be accepted. It was published, sent out to about 3,000 paper subscribers, put online. And then our dean, Eric Nielsen, decided that one of the articles that I had published apparently violated a branding agreement he had made between the medical school and the hospital corporation at Northwestern. And so he pulled it because he was afraid it might make the hospital look bad. So he censored the work.
And what was so controversial about this?
It was a story by a cultural anthropologist who became spinal cord injured at the age of 18, Syracuse University's anthropologist Bill Peace, and he told the story of what happened to him in a rehabilitation hospital 35 years before, where he ended up in a relationship with a nurse where they ended up having one consensual sex act. And what upset the dean was, I guess, his idea that this would somehow imply something bad about our hospital, but I found that rather absurd. It was a story about a rehabilitation hospital 35 years earlier. And Peace was telling the story not from a pornographic standpoint. It's very clear from the article that he's talking about the ways in which people with disability don't have their sexuality addressed and raising the question, do we yet address the sexual needs of people with disabilities? How are we going to sort of finally deal with this question?
I'm speaking with Alice Dreger. She's a former professor of clinical medical humanities and bioethics at the Feinberg School of Medicine at Northwestern University. If you want to join our conversation about free speech on college campuses, our number is 1-800-222-9455. Right now, we're talking about academic freedom. We're going to be talking about students and protests and free speech as well later on in the hour. Alice, you ironically were in the middle of, I think you just finished publication of your book, Galileo's Middle Finger, Heretics, Activists, and the Search for Justice in the Sciences, as all of this was going on. And so I guess my question for you is, why did you feel like this was an issue you needed to resign over?
Well, you know, there was an 18-month window between the time he censored the work and the time I finally resigned, because I kept hoping Northwestern would come around. Northwestern had been a great place for me to work in terms of academic freedom. And in fact, the book that I published was full of controversial work that I had done, and it was specifically about academic freedom. It was the university that had made possible Galileo's Middle Finger, the book that I was doing page proofs and final fact-checking when the censorship occurred. And it felt incredibly ironic. In fact, I went to the dean's office and I said, you don't understand. I have a national book coming out about academic freedom. Don't put me in this position. And they just kept saying, congratulations on your book. And I want to point out, it wasn't just that they had censored this one article. After they censored this, they decided that we were not to be trusted. And so they instituted a new so-called editorial committee, which we called the Censorship Committee. And it was going to be comprised of people from the Public Relations Department of the medical school and the dean's office. And they would get to decide what we were allowed to publish and not publish. And that's just intolerable from an academic freedom standpoint. So I tried to get it fixed over 18 months. One of my colleagues, Christy Kirshner, who now works at UIC, resigned from our program over it. And I finally said, I can't be forced to choose between either doing the kind of work I do, which might upset my dean, or, you know, being disloyal to my colleagues. I just can't do that. So I can't be in the position where I'm causing fear among my colleagues. So I finally just quit last August.
Alice, as you're talking about the issue of academic freedom, for people who are listening who are not on a college campus, they maybe are in corporate environments or other environments that are not university environments. Why do you think that academic freedom is particularly such an important tenet for a university? Because in the corporate world, if you publish something, your manager thinks you go too far. I mean, there are consequences, and people might think, why is this such a big deal?
The fundamental thing we do at universities, really in the service of American democracy, is we create spaces where people can open their minds, have their minds changed, look for new information, and be changed by learning new information. And so for us to be able to do that, it means we have to be able to go where the data takes us, where the evidence takes us. It also means we sometimes have to go in places where discussions are uncomfortable, where ideas can be uncomfortable. That's part of what we do to train students to go out into the world to be people who are vibrant thinkers. We're not training people to go out and have a particular point of view. If that's the kind of teaching going on, I don't think that's a particularly good kind of teaching. But we have to have the kind of teaching and the kind of research where we can go where we need to go in terms of finding out new information. That enables us to be the sort of incubator for American democracy. The very fact that I, as a woman, for example, can be a PhD wearing pants, teaching students who are male students, would not have been really possible 150 years ago. It's because universities were places where these ideas could grow and could flourish and we're allowed to be uncomfortable that we have had American progress. So I think it's really important that we allow some level of discomfort and some level of disagreement on university campuses. We're not supposed to be corporations. And that's why the Northwestern situation was so shocking to me, because all of a sudden I found myself in a place where the faculty handbook technically said I had academic freedom and I was a faculty member. But in fact, the medical school was telling me I was a member of a corporation and I was loyal to the brand and I couldn't violate the brand. In fact, this creepy thing happened right about the same time, which was we were told to turn in our Northwestern University ID cards, our wild cards, and instead be issued a new brand card called Northwestern Medicine. And when they sent this out, I got sort of a chill through my spine thinking, oh man, does this mean I'm no longer faculty and no longer protected by academic freedom? And what the email said was, but don't worry, you'll still get 15% off at local restaurants and shops. Like, that is not what I'm worried about, my 15% discount. I am seriously worried about whether or not I can do the kind of work that I do that sometimes makes people uncomfortable.
Alice, and to that point of uncomfortable, I want to ask you a question about the student side. I was myself a student at Northwestern University once upon a time. And to that note about extending that conversation, and you're talking about academic freedom, I want to shift a little to just the notion of free speech and what students say and what students can say that make other students uncomfortable, or perhaps even things that are very controversial, like what we've seen. The University of Illinois last week had multiple cases of swastikas drawn on buildings. Where do you think the limits are in terms of free speech, and where is the line?
You know, I think it's perfectly fine for university administrations when facing things like swastikas to hold unity marches and to say, you know, we welcome everybody on our campus and it's not okay for people to feel intimidated. But it's quite another thing to tell people what we can write about, what we can think about, what we can teach. And that starts to go really over the line. You know, I understand we want to create places where our students feel comfortable, but the fact is when you come to a university, some of what you're going to experience is uncomfortable in terms of meeting people you've not met before, running into ideas that may be disorienting, may be uncomfortable. That's part of what it means to go to a university. And does that mean we let everybody just go ahead and say whatever they want and never question them? No, absolutely not. In fact, we do need to question each other, to have difficult arguments, to have disagreements. That's where I really admire what the University of Chicago put out under Jeff Stone, the Chicago Principles, and this is something being adopted by a lot of universities. It talks very explicitly about the role of the university and says quite specifically that the role of the university administration is not to adjudicate disagreements. It is to allow us as faculty and as students to have those disagreements, to have those arguments, and do it in a way that has respect but also sometimes gets uncomfortable.
Thanks for bringing up that point. That's Alice Dreger. She's a former professor at Northwestern University's Feinberg School of Medicine, who resigned in protest last August, as she's been explaining the consequences that led to her resignation, or the situation that led to that. Our phone number is 1-800-222-9455. As we're talking to you, you can tweet us as well if you tweet to 21st Show. Let's go to Isabel in Champaign-Urbana. Hi, Isabel. Welcome to the 21st. What's your comment on this issue?
My comment had to do with the student side and, you know, completely supportive of students' free speech, but I also think that university campuses have a responsibility to clearly communicate what the expectations are for students and to hold students accountable to those expectations. I think we need to code. I think we need to make it clear to students what those student codes say and what expect of them, and we need to hold students accountable.
Okay, thanks for that, Isabel. As we're talking about that, I want to bring someone else into the conversation. Alice Dreger mentioned the University of Chicago, and one of the organizations that just highlighted what UFC did is FIRE. That's the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education. The group advocates for free speech, among other issues on college campuses. Azhar Majeed is that organization's director of policy reform, and he joins now by phone from his office. Hey, Azhar, how are you?
Good. Thank you. Good morning to you, and thank you for having me.
Good morning. I wanted to ask you, before we get specifically to the University of Chicago, as Alice has pointed out, they've been recognized for their efforts to protect free speech. You all compile a list of schools based on how well or not they're doing in terms of protecting free speech. Where do Illinois campuses rank on that list?
You know, unfortunately, I have to say not very well. You know, I do have the good news to share that the University of Chicago recently worked with FIRE to improve their speech codes and to improve to our highest free speech rating, which is a green light rating. And what that indicates is that all of their policies fully protect student and faculty speech rights and follow First Amendment standards. Unfortunately, the University of Chicago is the only such school in Illinois to earn a green light rating. There are 27 such schools in the country, but only one in the state of Illinois. And, you know, given cases like Professor Dreger's at Northwestern, you know, I would have to say that the other schools in the state are not faring as well as the University of Chicago.
What did U of C do then to get that good rating? What specifically are those guidelines? What do they look like?
Well, so, you know, in addition to the free speech statement that was produced by Professor Jeff Stone and his committee on campus, the University of Chicago worked with FIRE to improve a number of policies that previously regulated and overly restricted student speech and faculty speech. So these policies included, had to do with campus demonstrations, student postings on campus, so-called bias incidents, all kinds of different speech codes that overly regulated speech. And what they've done, you know, in conjunction with FIRE is to improve those policies to meet First Amendment standards.
How important is it? Our caller Isabel was just saying that this needs to be clearly communicated. How important is that once you have a policy in place to make sure that everyone on campus knows about it?
Yeah, it's extremely important. You know, from the moment that students come to campus, they should be, you know, they should be told that this is a place where everyone is encouraged to engage in the free exchange of ideas. And, you know, with that, you will sometimes be exposed to viewpoints that you find offensive or controversial, and you may have your most deeply held beliefs challenged at some point. You know, that's part of an education. An education in a university setting is more than just reading textbooks and writing, you know, papers for a class. And this is how you can gain some of your most valuable education in the college setting.
Azar, if you can stick around before we're going to take a break in a minute. If you can stick around, Alice, before I let you go, I just want to ask, what's next for you?
Well, you know, I'm still doing all the same work I was doing. I'm just not doing it at Northwestern, so I'm continuing on with my life. It was very disappointing to me to be in that position, but as I'm traveling the country talking about this issue, talking about the issue of academic freedom, I'm finding more and more academics all over the country who feel very much the way we do with regard to seeing the incredible need for making sure that we understand we are not corporations, that we need to be places that really are places where people can seek truth in the interest of also seeking justice in ways that they are protected. And we're not seeing that on university campuses today. We're seeing corporate administrations joining up with, unfortunately, leftists like me, but leftists who try to suppress a lot of free speech and with the idea that we just can't hear it. And that's creating a sort of toxic mix. So I'm finding a lot of friends as I travel around the country who I didn't know I had.
Jerry, you realize that as you travel around the country, do you feel like Illinois is in worse shape than the rest of the country? What's your sense of it?
You know, there's lots of different places where things are rough. I mean, in New York, I run into a lot of campuses where there's people being shut down because they're considered anti-Semitic or anti-Palestine. There are places in Wisconsin where people are under great stress because of what's happening with the Republican legislature. When I go to small liberal arts colleges, I'm hearing students are using the claim of trigger warnings to stop their professors from bringing up classic literature. Really, everywhere all over the country I go, I hear all sorts of problems with the idea that because we're empowered, we're allowed to shut people down.
That's Alice Dreger. Thanks for joining us. When we continue, we'll have this conversation about free speeches on college campuses, especially the student side of this. I'm Nyla Boodoo. You're listening to The 21st.
The 21st is made possible by Custer & Bradley, LLP, providing legal service to the Urbana-Champaign community since 1895, Custer & Bradley's attorneys are committed to achieving the best results for their clients. More information is available at CusterLawLLP.com.
Listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Today we're talking about free speech on college campuses. There have been lots of examples in recent years. Administrators removing an article from a publication at Northwestern, as we were just hearing, the University of Illinois, and Urbana withdrawing a job offer to a would-be professor based on the controversial comments about Israel on Twitter. We are talking about this right now with FIRE. They're an organization that works particularly with different college campuses on free speech. And my guest right now is Azar Majeed. We've been talking to him about the University of Chicago model. And Azar, with the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education, FIRE, as you all advocate for free speech around campuses, before the break, we were just talking about the University of Chicago model. Right. Do you think that's adaptable to other schools?
I absolutely think it's adaptable. And you have to keep in mind that, you know, the University of Chicago is not even a public institution that is legally bound by the First Amendment. You know, as a private institution, they can, you know, essentially make their own policies. And what they've chosen to do, and we commend them for this, is to fully protect student and faculty speech rights in all of their policies. You know, that's certainly a model for other schools to follow. And when you see, you know, a private institution doing this, irrespective of their legal obligations, then there's really no excuse for public universities like the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign and other schools throughout the state of Illinois to really do the same thing.
How does what the U of C is doing with that model for protecting free speech, how does that fit in with student-driven demands for, as we're hearing, student protests about having safe spaces, trigger warnings? How does that fit into this conversation about whether or not, how does that fit into the free speech conversation?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think it can be, you know, in addition to being a policy statement, I think it can really be an educational material or an educational tool for students throughout the University of Chicago and other college campuses. You know, when you read the statement and you fully understand what it stands for, you know, as a student, you should be able to realize that even if you're offended by something that somebody else says, or even if you absolutely disagree with it, that, you know, unless it's one of the very few exceptions to the First Amendment, something like defamation or harassment or obscenity, then more than likely it's protected, and it should be protected in a free society. And so I think the University of Chicago statement can really, be a learning tool for students out there to know about what discourse and debate should look like in a free society.
When you say that, particularly things that are not offensive, I guess that's a really tough part of this, right? Because that's where we get into the area where students say that they have issues, the things that are not just maybe offensive, but even racist. Where does that come into play?
Well, I think students are free to disagree with somebody, certainly, who espouses racist viewpoints or sexist viewpoints. And what have you, but that doesn't mean that they should automatically call for censorship and for disciplinary investigations. And I think the University of Chicago statement speaks to this. It says that, if you encounter speech that you disagree with, the best recourse that you have is to use your own voice and to engage in counter speech. You know, you can use strength in numbers, because if you have many other people on your campus who agree with you and who want to say that your campus community does not stand for that kind of racist speech, then you can use a public rally on the campus, or you can use a petition or many other tools that are at your disposal to make clear to other people that this is not what this campus community stands for.
So you're saying essentially fight free speech with more free speech.
Exactly. And I think too many students have lost sight of that, or maybe were never taught that lesson in the first place, that in a free society, you can always speak out and use your own voice. And in that way, not only, respond to something that you don't like, but, maybe you can get some new converts or convince some other people as to why your viewpoint is the right one, and why somebody who's spewing racist, hatred, sexist commentary, why they, what they're saying has no merit, in their statements.
That's Azhar Majeed. He's with FIRE. It's the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education. They advocate for free speech, particularly on college campuses. I want to bring someone else into this conversation as well. Her name is Marsha Chatlin. She's a Chicago native. She now teaches history and African-American studies at Georgetown University in Chicago. She just wrote an article in Dissent magazine called The Free Speech Straw Man. Marsha, welcome to the 21st.
Hi.
As you're listening to Azhar speak about sort of the notion of fighting free speech with more free speech, you wrote a really interesting piece. We'll tweet out the link. If you follow 21st Show, you can see the article that she wrote. And I actually was doing my own little highlights of it, Marsha, so you can go and see where I highlighted everything you wrote. But for me, what I thought stood out was your argument that you think you're calling arguments for free speech a straw man. Why is that?
Well, what I'm calling a straw man is this sense that universities don't have a special role in terms of really encouraging discourse that's thoughtful. I think what tends to happen in these free speech conversations on campus is that a series of critiques or discomforts with universities get folded into this free speech issue, and they're actually not issues of speech. They might be issues of platform. They may be issues of power. They may be issues of critique, but they're not necessarily free speech. And so I think it's really dangerous when people think that by, raising the flag of free speech, they're actually protecting speech, when in fact, it sometimes becomes an insidious way to make other critiques of what they believe is happening or not happening on university campuses.
Because your argument is also about power and marginalization.
Right. And I think that what tends to happen is that when marginalized groups on campus ask for civility or consideration or even an opportunity to express, some type of issue on a campus, I think that there's a tendency to say, well, we are impairing free speech if we ask for civility, or we are impairing this or that. And I think it becomes this disingenuous way of not listening to really thoughtful critique or even engaging the possibility that the institution as it stands needs some work. And so I think that what we've seen over this past academic year with student protest is the strange way that this free speech question is brought out, but it really can't resolve some of the fundamental questions that are being asked about the memorialization of the past on campus, of race relations, of diversity, of gender issues, of sexual assault. That free speech does not necessarily answer any of those questions, but I think that sometimes that becomes a default position to not engage it.
As you mentioned students, I wanted to play a little bit of audio for our audience. And I think probably the most famous example of this that we have this past year is in March, because Donald Trump canceled his rally on the campus of the University of Chicago, or UIC, sorry. And students told, I wanted to play this. This is students telling WLS-TV they were disappointed about not being able to stop his visit.
It's not just offensive to us, the things that he's spreading, but it's also something we feel unsafe, here on campus, having someone like that here and his supporters.
I don't think that they should be supporting him because he does go against everything UIC says. UIC is such a diverse campus, and the fact that he wants, his immigration laws and LGBTQ and how he's against that, we don't support it.
Those were students talking to WLS-TV before Donald Trump canceled the rally. Now, I wanted to contrast that with yesterday, because this is, I think you can hear kind of how students are talking about this. This is yesterday, Southern Illinois University junior L.C. Tockington speaking to WISU Public Radio during a protest yesterday in Carbondale.
They're not making people feel safe, because I know in my class this morning there was only 10 people in there out of 30. And a lot of people were saying they weren't going to come today because they didn't know what was going to happen. They were scared. I think they just need to put all their signs down and be mature and be adults and go out in the real world and get a job and then pay off your student loans just like that.
That's at Southern Illinois University. It's interesting to me, and Marsha and Azar, I'd love for both of you to comment on this, how both of these students use the word safe. And I wonder, Marsha, how you kind of contrast both of that and how that's being reflected in the conversation today.
Right. So when we look at the kind of violence that can erupt when we have very heated ideologues like Donald Trump speaking, I don't think it is a leap of the imagination to think that there are certain people who might feel that their physical safety can be threatened as a result of what is being said, or if they feel like, are there adequate mechanisms for protection? And so each college campus, we make decisions every day about safety. We make decisions about where we locate buildings, about fire exits. So again, our discourse on safety gets most attacked when we talk about the emotional, physical safety of the members of our community. And these arguments that people are not being grown-ups, we have so many mechanisms that mediate experiences. We have ratings on television and movies, right? Most people have a sense that some conversations may not be appropriate in every setting. And we have these general rules of civility for a reason. And I think it's interesting that once it emerges from college students, and usually college students of color and other marginalized college students, it becomes a problem. There's nothing in our society that indicates that we don't try to have some sensitivity towards adults. And so I just think that this is a really dangerous rabbit hole to go down. And so when we talk about people feeling unsafe, we are talking about real threats to physical safety, and we are talking about real strategies for intimidation. These things are not made up. But I think that there's a way that, students who are simply advocating for their own humanity are often degraded, and they're cut off before they can really get an audience to understand what they're talking about.
That's Marsha Chatlin. I wanted to bring Azar Majeed back into the conversation with FIRE. Azar, what's your response to that in terms of how FIRE looks at this issue? Obviously, your intention is to protect and preserve free speech on campus. How do you do that balance that against all of these other needs that Marsha's talking about?
Yeah, and I certainly recognize that there is a balance there, but I do get nervous anytime I see the rationale of emotional safety brought out, in response to a controversial speaker on campus or, anything along those lines. Because, while physical safety, of course, is a paramount obligation, students on college campuses who are overwhelmingly adults, legally speaking, that, you know, it's difficult to say in a free society that you have a right to be free of anything that threatens your emotional safety. And you know, and that's such a subjective term that it's really in the eye of the beholder, and it's difficult for somebody to consistently apply that rationale. And when you have students calling for safe spaces on campus, I think, you know, again, that's a subjective call, and students or other speakers ahead of time have no way of knowing whether their speech might offend somebody to the point that it, you know, quote-unquote, threatens their emotional safety. So, you know, I things like civility, of course, are important. You know, personally, I like civil speech, and I like to think that I'm a civil person. But, you know, once you make that a legal requirement under university policy such that somebody can be punished for engaging in quote-unquote uncivil speech, you're giving a lot of discretion to the administration and to the policymakers to punish speech and to censor speech as they see fit.
Now, Marcia, you're not necessarily saying there's a legal obligation. It sounds like you're saying there's more of a moral or societal obligation.
What I'm suggesting is that we form communities at universities in order for our students to be able to replicate the very best of community in the outside world. And I also think it's interesting that at the very moment you have these contestations about safe space, and, you know, I think that, you know, the other guest said something about emotional safety, we also have the most heightened discourse about mental health on campus. And it's these things are not separate. That if we think about an inability to try to promote civility, to expand safety emotionally, it also contributes to the big issue that universities are trying to tackle with mental health. They're not separate, but I do think that we think of the people who advocate for this and need it as different. And so I think that the face of a lot of mental health issues on campus around depression and suicide and anxiety is one group, and they organize around this idea of getting those resources on campus. And then another group that's also asking for a kind of safety is, I think, largely vilified because it does come from a lot of students of color. And so I think that there's a relationship between these two, and if we could start to think about it holistically, about how we meet the needs of a community in a way that does not always default to this idea that just because you're an adult, you don't need a level of respect and civility. I think that's one of the worst examples that we can put in front of kids, that once you're an adult, there can't be an expectation that people try to find common cause with you and that it's all hostility that you have to navigate.
Marcia, we just have about a minute left, but I want to ask you, what do you tell your students about how to create this community and balance that with the rights and responsibilities that come along with free speech?
Right. We talk about consequences, that every action has a consequence. But one of the things that I think has been really important to me as someone who teaches about race and injustice is that I don't build community only on the days where I want to talk about difficult things. I think one of the greatest dangers in thinking that universities are the place to have difficult dialogues is that we forget that we have to build a community first. So we have to talk about sports. We have to talk about common interests. We have to talk about activities on campus. We have to talk about the easier things in order to get to the difficult things. And I think pedagogically, we have to encourage our educators to really build community in dynamic and multifaceted ways so that when we have to do something difficult, we actually have the trust and the kindness and the support of the class environment to do that. So I think it's multi-steps. And so what I tell my students is that they're important to me. I want to know about every dimension of their life, and that when we have to do something difficult, we at least have the safety of knowing each other so that we can have disagreements and we can have conflict in a way that doesn't feel so destructive.
That's Marcia Chatlin. Thanks for being with us. She's a Chicago native. It's great to have you back on the air here in Illinois. She's the author of the book Southside Girls, Growing Up in the Great Migration. She teaches history and African-American studies at Georgetown University. And we tweeted a link to the article she wrote in Dissent Magazine about this issue if you follow 21st Show. Marcia, thanks for being with us.
All right. Thank you so much.
Thanks also to Azar Majeed, the director of policy reform at the Foundation for Individual Rights and Freedom. That's FIRE. If you follow us on Facebook, you can also see the links we put out with their ratings of Illinois schools. Azar, thanks for being with us as well.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Coming up on the 21st, a wildlife park near Peoria had a problem with some of their animals. They were overweight. We're going to find out what they did to change that and what humans can learn from their experience. Stay with us. You're listening to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo.
21st is made possible by the Library at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, preparing students and scholars for their fields by offering access to today's cutting-edge equipment and technology within advanced library environments and facilities. The University Library at Illinois.
Welcome back to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Maybe you read the New York Times Magazine story this weekend analyzing how tough long-term weight loss was for the very obese. They actually were looking at season 8 winners from The Biggest Loser. It's been making the rounds on social media this week. Well, you know, it turns out the struggle to maintain a healthy weight is not unique to humans. Animals living in enclosures such as state parks can also have a difficult time keeping their figures trim. That was the case for the animals at Wildlife Prairie Park just outside Peoria and Hanna City. The caretakers there got some help from researchers at the University of Illinois School of Veterinary Medicine to help the animals slim down. And joining us to talk about this now are two people who are part of that effort. Dr. Julia Whittington is the Clinical Associate Professor and Head of the Companion Exotic Animal Medicine Service at the U of I and joins us in studio. On the line with us from Hanna City is Adrian Bauer, Animal Curator at Wildlife Prairie Park. Both of you, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for having us.
How overweight were the animals at Wildlife Prairie Park? Adrian, do you want to tell us?
For the main part, it was our bears that were the biggest problem. We have a male black bear that was weighing 756 pounds, and we had a female black bear that weighed 442 pounds. We also had a pair of badgers and our bobcats that were overweight.
What's the average for a bear? Now all of a sudden I'm thinking, what is the BMI for a bear supposed to be? Do you measure body mass index for a bear?
You can. I don't believe we did the body mass index on him.
Dr. Whittington, how do you normally know if an animal is overweight?
Well, you look at a variety of parameters. Usually animals are assessed not only for their weight but also their body condition, and that's done on a score basis. The score range can be anywhere from 1 to 5 or 1 to 9, depending on the type of animal. But you measure the body fat, especially as it lies over the ribs and over the rump. You can assess the skeletal system and how much soft tissue is overlying those structures as well.
Adrian, did you all just look at the bears and think, and the other animals and think, oh, maybe we have a problem? Or how did you guys figure out there was an issue?
You could definitely tell by looking at them that they were overweight. And as they're getting older, their movements are slowing down, but their weight was definitely slowing them down a lot more.
Mm-hmm. So you mentioned bears. What other animals are we talking about?
We're talking about badgers, bobcats, and two cougars.
Okay. And how do you force those animals to exercise?
We did a variety of enrichment. So we changed out some things in their enclosures and basically gave them some larger toys that would help them exercise. There was a special case with our female black bear, Molly. She has a double fence, so the keepers are able to safely jog along her fence line where she can't get to them, and she was jogging with them for quite some time.
Was she jogging with them or was she chasing them?
She was jogging with them. She actually seemed to have a lot of fun with it. And now that it's getting warmer out, she has a pool that she can go into.
Dr. Whittington, how did you all work to come up? I mean, it sounds pretty logical, right? You try to get them to exercise, you watch their diet. But do you have to come up with specific activities for specific animals?
Well, fortunately, we didn't have to do that. When we started this partnership with Wildlife Prairie Park 2 years ago, our primary goal was just basic assessment of the health of these animals. We didn't have weight loss as a primary goal. However, as we worked with these animals and as we worked with the park staff, we were able to identify that several of these animals would benefit from a healthy reduction in not only their caloric intake, but an increase in their exercise. And so after doing health exams on all of the animals at the park, we sat down with the park staff and said, well, what are you feeding? What are the animals actually catching inside their enclosure that you can't control? And how can we make adjustments in a safe and healthy way that will promote the well-being of these animals?
Adrian, does that happen a lot? Are the animals catching other food that staff obviously can't control because it's just kind of them doing their thing?
Yeah, that does actually happen a lot. At the Prairie Park, it's a 2,000-acre zoological park, like you said, right outside of Peoria. And the enclosures are basically fenced off in a wooded area, and it's meant to stimulate them in a natural environment and simulate the natural environment. So
Unfortunately, there are wild animals that are around here, and they do get in the enclosure quite frequently with the animals.
And then they get eaten.
Sometimes that does happen, yes.
Okay. So, Dr. Whittington, how did you work with this? Did you tell them to hide food, or did you guys come up with that exercise?
Actually, we came up with recommendations as to what items to feed,
and
by that I mean how much vegetable matter, how much protein, what type of protein, whether it be a lean protein or a plant protein. But then Adrienne and her staff, knowing these animals as well as they do, and having a very good understanding of the enclosures and what it is capable of, worked to come up with these enrichment ideas.
How did you do that, Adrienne?
Well, we kind of went on an individual basis. One of our cougars is far more active than the other, so it was different programs for them. And then as far as our bears, our black bear TR has a bigger enclosure, so we were able to hide his food in a lot of different places out in the yard, and that just got him up and moving, and he naturally lost that weight just moving around his enclosure like he should and finding his food. Molly, we had to do a little bit more exercising with, and the cougars, we were definitely introducing a lot more boxes for them to tear apart and hiding some of their food out in their yard as well.
We're speaking with Adrienne Bauer. She's an animal curator at Wildlife Prairie Park, as she said, just outside of Peoria, and also Dr. Julia Whittington, a veterinary medicine who teaches that here at the University of Illinois. Adrienne, when you're saying that you were hiding things, I imagine for you, did you notice a difference in their, I guess you were giving them a lot of intellectual stimulation as well. Did that change their energy level? I don't know if you felt like it changed their moods.
I think it has. We've gotten the compliment lately that these are the most active that some of our guests have seen the animals in years, and I think it is. I just started here 2 years ago, but I can tell TR is moving all over his enclosure now. He's utilizing the whole space. In the past, he was probably only utilizing about half of it. He's digging dens like he naturally would in the wild, and he just seems like he's a whole different bear.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Whittington, how important is the mental stimulation part of this for animals that are in an enclosed area like they are at Wildlife Prairie Park?
I think that's the biggest challenge facing curators and other staff who are in charge of captive wildlife. With our domestic animals, it's less of an issue. They're actually quite happy being confined, being in a comfortable place, feeling secure, being around people. But even though many of the animals at Wildlife Prairie Park and as well as other zoos have been bred and raised in captivity, they are still innately wild. And if the enclosure that they're housed in or the situation that they are experiencing does not allow them to demonstrate natural behaviors, then we get what we call stereotypic behavior of stress. So you may have seen at the zoo a big cat pacing along the cage. You may see some animals actually self-mutilating if they're under a significant amount of stress. Sometimes we see actual medical conditions develop because of the stress of captivity. So anything that you can do to allow these animals to behave in a natural way is extremely important to their captive well-being.
Adrienne, I imagine there are people listening to this who are starting to feel really sorry for these animals. They're probably all zoo animals in particular. And they're thinking, wow, now they're also overweight. I mean, they should be set free. What do you say to people? What's your response to people who would say that?
A lot of these animals, especially here at our park, can't be released into the wild. They have sustained some kind of an injury that just they wouldn't survive out in the wild. Most of our animals come from a rehab situation. So we're doing the best that we can to give them their normal life back within these enclosures.
Dr. Whittington, are animals in the wild, this sounds like a dumb question, but are animals in the wild, do they get overweight? Like, there must be overweight bears out there, right?
Actually, animals in the wild are much, as long as they're in a natural habitat. So you have to remember, some of the animals that we come across in the wild are no longer in what we would consider a natural habitat because they have found your garbage can or your bird feeder.
Right. Okay.
Or they're being fed, you know, whatever you happen to be providing them. But most wild animals will regulate their own weight in a natural way, and that weight can vary with season. Certainly, they will lay down extra fat during the winter because they'll need that that store due to depleted food supplies, et cetera. But most of them will maintain a healthy weight.
I think that I mentioned at the beginning of the segment, there was a New York Times story this weekend. It was a new research study that looked at the contestants of the reality TV show Biggest Loser. And it was kind of, I've seen it on a lot of Facebook pages in the past couple of days. It was pretty depressing, actually, because it was just how much people who had gone through extreme weight loss, how difficult it was for them to keep the weight loss off. Does the same thing happen with animals? Do we even know? Because the article sort of left it up in the air. It seems like we don't know a lot about even humans' weight loss in this field.
Yeah, it's so multifactorial. Will it happen in animals? It absolutely can. But because their diets are controlled by people, it is less likely to do so. So any reason why their weight would come back on is because they are suffering from some sort of metabolic disorder, or they're becoming aged and their activity level is decreasing, or we're providing them with more food. So really, those are the three things that are going to mostly affect weight loss or gain. Whereas in people, we have become a society of convenience. We also have a lot of access to processed food, and we use food socially. So if somebody has undergone a lot of weight loss and they're struggling with keeping it off, you know, I think mostly we have to go back and look at why is food being used as part of their life. There can be genetic reasons mm-hmm. for weight gain or loss as well.
Adrian, do you find that because the animals are in an enclosed environment, do they have that same social food thing that people have in terms of you all and when you're feeding them and how that involves interaction?
They definitely recognize us and recognize when it's feeding time. We try not to feed them at the same time every day just so that they don't get used to being fed at the exact same time. But I definitely think they use it somewhat socially. Our foxes, for example, they're not always hungry, but they want what you have. So they like to
that sounds
kind of
familiar.
Steal it.
Right.
Yeah, they just like to steal it from each other and run around the yard and hide it places.
And were you worried about when you began this a year or two ago, now that they're kind of in pretty good shape, were you worried about what the health effects would have been if they were overweight? And I don't even know what those would have been, Adrian.
Well, definitely you worry about their joints with being overweight. Obviously, their weight gets spread out a little bit better because they're on all fours, but still, then they have four joints that are being affected by the weight. Also, their heart was another concern for us.
Mm-hmm. And I see you, Dr. Whittington, you're nodding your head here. I want to ask you about people's pets in a second. But before I get to that, Adrian, are there things that you all have learned that would be useful to other animal parks and zoos?
Definitely. I would say for us, the thing that we learned the most was that it was extremely beneficial for them to just get their diet out in their enclosure, spread out over the area for them, rather than in a dish in one location.
Mm-hmm. Have you heard from other zoos or parks since the news of this came out a week or two ago?
No, not as of date, we haven't.
That's Adrian Bauer. She's the animal curator at Wildlife Prairie Park, telling us about the diet that the bears, badgers, bobcats, the foxes did. It sounds like the foxes did not have to go on a diet.
No, the foxes didn't. They're fairly active.
Okay. Dr. Whittington, for people who are listening with their pets, if they might be wondering, is it a big deal if their cat or dog is overweight? What would you say?
Oh, absolutely. Obesity is a big problem in veterinary medicine, and we can see any number of manifestations that occur secondary to obesity. For instance, diabetes, arthritis, osteopathies, joint disease, atherosclerosis, and cardiac disease. So a whole slew of conditions that you would expect to see in people with the same condition.
And what advice do you have for pet owners about putting their pets on a diet if they're listening to this? So they probably, I don't know if we want people hiding their cat's food across the house in different places.
Yeah, well, you know, I would give the the same advice that I would give to a person, that there, frankly, is no magic pill. There is no substitute to decreasing the calories, increasing the quality of the diet fed, and exercise.
Okay, so it's the same thing for cats, dogs, bears, and people, it sounds like.
That's right.
That's Dr. Julia Whittington. She's an associate, she's a clinical associate professor and head of the Companion Exotic Animal Medicine Service at the University of Illinois. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Thanks also to Adrian Bauer, animal curator at Wildlife Prairie Park just outside of Peoria. Thanks, Adrian.
Thank you.
That does it for today's show. Special thanks to WISU Public Radio in Carbondale for the audio of yesterday's campus protest. Sorry, it's WSIU in Carbondale for the audio of yesterday's campus protest. That's what we just played during our segment on free speech. Coming up on tomorrow's 21st, Illinois has the highest property taxes in the country. We'll look at why that's the case and if they'll go up more. Thanks for listening to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo.